Today is January 21st, and I'm back with Wang Shi in his office at the Burnham Institute for the third and final Pew interview. So there were a few things that I wanted to kind of go back and touch on from yesterday. We talked just a little bit about competition and the fact that your field is, you're pretty much the only one doing it. But on a more philosophical level, how do you think competition affects the sciences?
Competition affects the sciences. It's a good thing in terms of moving a field fast once mm-hmm. the field is started by some pioneers. So the work can get done really fast. Mm-hmm. For example, the RB field was started out with the cloning of the gene by three or four independent groups. So it's already in the beginning there was a big competition. But then the competition gets even more severe once the gene mm-hmm. are in hand. And many people started requesting the genes, and they like to get involved, and they like to work on those. And indeed, the field has moved really fast. There were many papers published, and many times two or three papers were published on the same topic with the same kind of conclusions, similar set of data. That was already, I mentioned in my case, both of my papers on RB during the postdoc period was accompanied by similar papers by other groups. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, it's good for this field that you got lots of activities going on, and that people immediately quickly learn a lot of things about this field. So, on the other hand, the really creative work really do not result from competition. You know, mostly, the field, the person who pioneering a field usually do not have any competition when he was mm-hmm. working alone. And mm-hmm. and for example, even for the case of RB, the cloning was a competition, but then figuring out the mechanisms really have something to do with this Professor Ed Harlow's work early on, before RB was even cloned, that he was working on proteins that would bind to the E1A viral oncogene. And three or four years before the cloning of RB, he had identified a group of dozen proteins that would bind to E1A. And of course, he had no idea what the identities of those proteins are. And then all of a sudden, he realized, once the gene for RB was cloned, the protein product identified, he realized the one of his proteins have very similar size with RB. So he just tested whether that would turn out to be RB. And indeed, it was RB. And this opened up the idea that RB somehow works by binding to proteins. And also, this led to the idea that viral oncogenes transform cells by binding to cellular tumor suppressor genes like RB, and it somehow inactivates the tumor suppressors. That's how maybe they transform. So this idea really was started out by him working with that E1A binding proteins. And at the time he was working on that, really there wasn't much competition. And his work was pretty much ignored. And people think just a whole bunch of protein sticky to viral protein. And what's the significance of that?
Mm-hmm.
Really, he has no idea. And it wasn't until he found one of them is RB, then all of a sudden, every one of these guys are becoming important.
Mm-hmm.
And people start cloning more and more of those binding proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, several have turned out to be very important later
mm-hmm.
on. So you have to give El Hallo credit for sticking with his work.
Mm-hmm.
While you know there's no competition, no other people are interested in his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he was having a tough time, I understood, at the time to continue that line of work.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for RB to come out at that particular time, he might have trouble to continue that line of work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there are many examples like this that you can, from history, that there are many creative works that was not generated by competition.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly the real creative work are done by somebody working along and
mm-hmm.
on something very unique
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
that later on turned out to be some general interest
mm-hmm.
of general importance,
mm-hmm.
right? So really I think competition is not really the ideal way of doing science. If doing science is to really be creative. And so competition maybe is for the other type of way of doing science, which is just to generate data
mm.
and to get grants.
That's
a nice way of doing it. Because if you go into a competitive field, no matter if that field is, the only way that field can become competitive is because that topic is hot at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So you may have a lot more competition, but because it's hot, everything you touch should be fundable and should
mm-hmm.
be publishable. So if you want to get involved in this topic, you can always do something that's going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if they are similar to what other people are doing, it doesn't matter. You still get your results published,
mm-hmm.
you still get funded.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's a kind of more sure way of pursuing
mm-hmm.
things. You know you're going to get something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you work on something nobody's doing, you have no idea in the end if you're going to get anything out of
mm-hmm.
this.
Right.
So it's less risky, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you may think it's more risky if you work
mm-hmm.
on a competitive field,
mm-hmm.
right? Get scooped or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened to you? Because you said your paper came out at the same time as another paper. Did that scoop you or not?
Yeah. In those two cases that I managed to publish, I didn't get scooped.
Mm-hmm.
But I did get scooped for my third paper out of my postdoc, which is to say that the E2F is
mm-hmm.
the RB binding protein. As my paper in Nature had identified a protein that's 46 kilodalton size. 46 kilodalton in molecular weight inside a binds to RB. That was a band in the gel.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have any idea what this protein is in terms of sequence and stuff. But that was enough to be published in Nature because it established the concept that cellular proteins exists that binds to RB. Now the next question for us is to figure out what is this protein.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, E2F was not known yet. E2F was known, but it wasn't known that it binds to RB.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So there are certain papers published around that time by Joe Nevin's lab in Cell saying that E2F was released by E1A somehow. The E2F activity can be regulated by E1A. Mm-hmm. And E2F has certain molecular size. They figure it's about 50 kilodalton. So I had, at the time, made a very reasonable guess that E2F looks very like very much like an RB binding protein. Probably it's the 46K that I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
So based on that idea, I had made some collaboration with E2F people, and they indeed confirmed that E2F is the RB binding protein.
Mm-hmm.
And then we tried to publish that, and we sent to Nature the paper. And then they say they already had similar papers in press.
Mm.
So they cannot take ours anymore.
Mm.
So then in the end, we didn't manage to have our paper published in the same time period
mm-hmm.
and the same group of journalists as three
mm-hmm.
or four
mm-hmm.
papers that are published in Cell and Nature
mm-hmm.
that all say the same thing,
mm-hmm.
that E2F binds to RB.
Yeah.
So in a way, I was scooped in that instance.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the questions about competition is, it does spur people on to work and to get things done and to try to get the information out in a timely manner.
Mm-hmm.
But it can sometimes, I think, lead to sloppy science in the rush to get something out. Have you experienced that at all?
That really is not the case, I don't think, because sloppy or not, the conclusion cannot be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the if they want to publish something, they must be very sure about
mm-hmm.
what they're trying to say. Maybe some of the data is not as solid,
mm-hmm.
but in the end, the conclusion should stand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you may need. You probably wish you had more
uh-huh.
more data to support it, but because of competition, you have to publish it now. But you're still pretty confident that it's
mm-hmm.
going to turn out to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, I think in some other instances, it has generated some artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And like a BRCA1 field, it was very controversial in terms of what this protein, where it is located, what's the size of it, and which band on this gel is the BRCA1 protein. At the time, Jazin was cloned,
mm-hmm.
and all these tumor suppressor guys switched from RB to BRCA.
Yeah.
And started making antibodies,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's trying to publish as quickly as they can. And then, indeed, there are very, different stories.
Mm-hmm.
The papers are published about the same time, but it got a very different conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody must be wrong. And if they would have more time, they could solve it.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, they cannot wait.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, identify such a protein by antibody is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
We can speak from our own experience in terms of identifying the RIS protein. We had misidentified a couple before we ran into the real result.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were under time pressure, we have to publish, and we may publish something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. With regard to the RIS, the work that you've been doing now for, you said, 8 years.
Yeah.
And you mentioned yesterday that you have very important data that you're writing up now and getting to publish. And I don't know if you want to go on the record yet, since it's not published, but it'll be a while before this hits the library shelf.
Yeah.
But what, in terms of this work, how is this going to contribute to our understanding of cancer?
Well, you know, right now, the field is basically characterizing the cancer genes. Mm-hmm. And we think cancer is caused by mutations in cancer genes. We indeed, in the past, have identified many of them.
And cancer genes or cancer suppressor genes?
Cancer genes can be classified into two groups, okay. Tumor suppressor genes and oncogenes.
Okay.
They operate yin-yang fashion.
Okay.
And for a lab like mine to have a place in this research, we need to have our own genes, our own cancer genes, instead of other ways we work on somebody else's cancer genes, mm-hmm. BRCA, RB. So I think it's much more important to come up with our own genes. And there are still many, many cancer genes remain to be discovered. And in addition, there are probably novel mechanisms of tumor genesis that's going to be discovered because of the new genes that's being mm-hmm. discovered. So that's our goal, is to identify new cancer genes, and if we are lucky, also we can identify new mechanisms of cancer genesis, tumor genesis. Mm-hmm. And so we have, after all these years, we have indeed solid evidence now that RIS is a new cancer gene. And probably it has some novel mechanisms of tumor genesis, which we are still not yet figured out. And in the meantime, we think we also identified a family of cancer genes that's related to RIS. And we probably have, this family probably have a dozen or so members. Mm-hmm. And so far, only three are characterized. And all three turn out to be cancer genes. So, in a way, we contributed to the cancer research field by adding new members of cancer genes. But our work really haven't changed the whole paradigm. The paradigm mm-hmm. is cancer results from mutations in cancer genes. Mm-hmm. And so I think for the next 5 or 10 years, this paradigm may still hold. And new discoveries is mainly going to be more discovery of cancer genes, more genes will be discovered. So eventually we hope we will be able to identify all the genes that's mutated in cancer. Mm-hmm. And then we can somehow generate a picture of exactly what's going on mm-hmm. in the cancer cell. Mm-hmm. And then we may have a handle on the mechanisms as mm-hmm. well as how to treat them. Mm-hmm.
So are these genes that you've identified, are these oncogenes or suppressor genes?
These are kind of a unique class of genes. They could be viewed as tumor suppressor genes. On the other hand, they also encode alternative products that act sort of like an oncogene. So in this family of genes, one gene give you at least two products due to two different promoters. The two products are basically identical in their C-terminal part. Mm-hmm. They differ a little bit at the N-terminus because of this domain that's defining this family, about 100 amino acid motif called the PR domain. And so you will have a gene that will give you a PR plus protein and a PR minus protein. So the only difference is the PR between these two.
But interestingly, the PR plus form appears to be tumor suppressive, whereas the PR minus form is oncogenic. Oh. So you can sort of like normally both products are expressed. So normally there will be a normal balance of the two. But in tumors, this balance was disrupted by one of the two ways. In the case of RIS, the PR plus form was always lost or mutated.
Mm-hmm.
And the PR minus form was always present in the tumors.
If the PR minus is the tumor suppressive.
No, the PR plus is the tumor
suppressive. It's the tumor suppressive, okay.
Yeah, the PR plus form is.
Okay.
In another gene of the family called MDS1 EVI1, then the PR minus form was overexpressed in tumors, whereas the PR plus form was disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So at least we have two cases, two genes mm-hmm. like that.
Okay.
That you can. In fact, the EVI1 gene, the MDS1 EVI1 gene, was first identified as an oncogene.
Uh-huh.
It was an oncogene, okay, and they didn't even know the existence of this PR plus form. They saw this gene just have this PR minus form.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through our work that we predicted there should be a PR plus form.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed there is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's the yin yang thing again.
Yeah, it's the yin yang thing. Yeah, within one gene.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, we can consider the oncogene and tumor suppressor genes. You know,
uh-huh.
there are yin yang balance there
mm-hmm.
too. Here is kind of unique. Within the same
within
gene,
you
got one yin yang
yeah.
there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Well. What kinds of, I mean, can you think of potential applications for this?
Yeah, potential applications, if gene therapy will work out in the end, if they can overcome some of the technical difficulties of delivering genes specifically
mm-hmm.
to the tumors, we might be able to use the PR family genes, use RIS1, in the gene therapy type of protocol to treat human cancers. We can use RIS1 in this way, same as we use P53
mm-hmm.
to do gene therapy of cancer. That's one possibility. The other one could be we can screen drugs, small compound that would somehow affect the RIS function
mm-hmm.
or affect the yin yang balance. RIS and to treat cancer using small compounds. And we can also think of, we can also maybe develop some compounds that would activate RIS1 expression in tumors. Because in tumors we saw loss of RIS1
mm-hmm.
expression, but the gene in most cases seemed to be intact.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the promoter for RIS1 is somehow inactivated
mm-hmm.
by something. So maybe it's possible if a compound can be found, can be identified, that can somehow reactivate RIS1
mm-hmm.
expression in tumors.
Mm-hmm.
So RIS1 maybe can be used in that fashion
mm-hmm.
for cancer treatment.
Is there any place for screening people for these genes? You know, like the BRCA1 and 2, they're screening tests for now.
Yeah.
I don't know what you do with the information once you get it. That's another whole ethical issue.
Right.
But Is that a possibility with these, or are you not sure?
Yeah, there is this reason may be a little different from BRCA. They are screening BRCA for normal, screen normal people for BRCA mutations, mm-hmm. because BRCA mutations are present in the germline, is actually being passed on. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if such germline type of mutations exist mm-hmm. for RIS, mm-hmm. and whether there is a cancer type that's familial cancer mm-hmm. and that was caused by RIS. Mm-hmm. We don't know that yet. Mm-hmm. It's possible, we just don't know. Mm-hmm. But at this point, so I don't see that screen normal people for RIS mutation. Mm-hmm. However, there might be RIS polymorphisms that one form of RIS versus the other may be more susceptible. People who carry that mm-hmm. one particular form may be more susceptible to mm-hmm. tumor formation. Mm-hmm. And then if we can screen, identify what these people are, I mean, what kind of RIS form they have, then this may give them some idea how susceptible they are to certain cancers. Mm-hmm. And, we have some work submitted in that direction. We have actually identified a RIS polymorphic allele. We have found that this allele is more popular in Asians, mm-hmm. Koreans, and Chinese versus Caucasians. And we have some evidence that this allele was a better tumor suppressor allele. Mm-hmm. So it's more powerful than the other ones. Mm-hmm. So if this one was more popular in Asian populations, we try to suggest maybe that has something to do with the lower tumor incidence in Asian populations versus Caucasians, mm-hmm. which was well known. Mm-hmm. Most people think that was due to the diet or something. Mm-hmm. But that may not be the case. Diet may not be the only thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. Because mm-hmm. they noticed this difference in tumor incidence, even among Asians living in the U.S.
Americanized and eating the junky right. food that Americans eat.
Right. Uh-huh. So.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay. Lots of things to think about. Of course, there are all kinds of social issues that revolve around testing people for predisposition for cancer.
Right. Mm. Yeah, it's going to need a lot of discussion on the government level mm-hmm. to see what they want to do with this. Mm-hmm. All this genomic information.
Yeah. Yep. Excuse me. Well, one of the things that I like to talk about is, and especially because yesterday you mentioned fate. Excuse me. Sometimes people stumble onto a great discovery by accident.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time that's what happened. Discovery is made by accident.
By serendipity.
Yes, serendipity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually the great ones are like that.
Mm-hmm. What about in your life?
In my case, serendipity. Well, for the work I did before. I become a professor, I don't think there's any accident involved. It was pretty well sort out logical. Mm-hmm. you know, the first work was for the postdoc work, you know, they have identified RB combined to UNA, so I want to know what domains of RB is in volume bonding, so just straightforward work to map the domains. And then the next thing is, you know, RB binds to UNA, you think there must be a UNA-like molecule in the cell that binds to RB, so you go ahead and identify that, no big deal. Now, I think in terms of in the Riz work, there are probably some luck involved. We gain something, we lose something in this case. We had thought that we were going to contribute to the RB work by isolating this Riz gene. But that has failed so far. We haven't really contributed much. In that regard. However, a good thing happened. The Riz has turned out to be important in its own right, without having relation to do with RB. So in a way, I set out to do the work without even dreaming about I would be able to clone or identify a novel cancer gene. And I was only hoping to get an RB binding protein and do something in relation to RB under the big RB umbrella.
Right.
Now I can see that Riz can itself become an important topic of study and has its own importance and interest to work on. Has become a tumor suppressor. And the way that I clone a Riz I found it as a tumor suppressor really is kind of luck, because normally to clone a tumor suppressor, it takes a lot more work. Usually involve a large group and very labor-intensive type of cloning. You go from positional cloning. You first identify where you think this tumor suppressor is on the chromosome, and then to walk from the site you know into the region. So typically it has been by positional cloning. That's how RB was cloned, that BRCA was cloned, and involved so many computations and a lot of work. So that's why when I started my lab, I didn't really dream of cloning such a gene, because just beyond my power to do it. But in the end, it came out this way. It was better than I had hoped.
How did it happen if it didn't happen the regular way?
Excuse me?
You said it didn't happen in the usual way with this positional cloning. So how did you stumble onto this gene?
Oh. Well, you clone it because it binds to RB.
Now, so you knew about it.
Now, it binds to RB, but that doesn't mean it's going to be a cancer gene.
Okay.
Just because something binds to RB doesn't mean, right? Mm-hmm. Now, gradually, we had found, piece by piece, that we realized it may be a cancer gene. How did it come about? First thing, there is a hint is because this gene shares a piece of homology with another gene. That was initially why we call this domain the PR domain. P stands for the other gene. R stands for Riz. So we had found this domain. And this didn't tell us really right away whether this is going to be a tumor suppressor or cancer gene, because the other gene was not known to be involved in cancer. But then we realized this PR motif is present in this cancer gene that I just told you, the EBI1 oncogene. So that tells you that this Riz gene is related to a known cancer gene. So it has the potential to become one itself too. And then we started having evidence that in cancer cells, the expression of RIS was altered. Like I told you, the RIS1 was always lost, and RIS2 was always there.
Mm-hmm.
Under normal circumstances, for a gene that has only one product, if you find that the product was lost in cancer cells, you would not be as impressed, because it could happen randomly,
mm-hmm.
because cancer cells are known to be unstable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find your gene product is present in this cell line but absent the other cell line, you probably wouldn't pay too much attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
But in our case, the yin-yang phenomenon was quite striking. The RIS2 is always present,
mm-hmm.
and there's almost like a selection for
mm-hmm.
it to be expressed.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, RIS1 was commonly found lost. So we think that has some real meaning to
mm-hmm.
it, and that's triggered us to suggest that RIS1 is a tumor suppressor
mm-hmm.
in that case. And then we another piece of serendipity luck is
mm-hmm.
has to do with the knockouts. We, in the beginning, when we first cloned RIS, we did not realize there is a RIS2 product. Okay, so we only know there is this PR plus form, RIS1.
Mm-hmm.
The short form we haven't realized in the beginning.
Okay.
So we had tried to do the knockout the moment we cloned the gene.
Mm-hmm.
So we know the PR motif in this N-terminus is important.
Mm-hmm.
So we set out to knock out this motif
mm-hmm.
in particular. Hopefully this will inactivate the whole gene.
Mm-hmm.
And we designed this targeting strategy without realizing there's a RIS2, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now it turned out to be, this strategy is turned out to be perfect for our idea to prove whether RIS1 lost but not RIS2
mm-hmm.
is going to cause cancer or not. Because this targeting strategy happened to just inactivate RIS1
mm-hmm.
without affecting RIS2. So we have created a mouse line
mm-hmm.
that mimic the human tumor situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So these mice do not express RIS1, but express RIS2. And what happened to these mice? And we initially have no idea because when we made these mice, we have no idea if RIS is going to be a tumor suppressor yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, and on the other hand, these mice are viable, they're normal, we cannot detect any abnormalities.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, this is a failure. We didn't succeed in achieving what we want to in terms of study the function of this. And we just sort of give it up on these mice.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we pretty much killed most of the mice colony, most of the animals. But fortunately, we have left about a dozen or so
mm-hmm.
alive. We kept them alive for, you know, for their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 2 years, about 20 months of age, we noted that these mice developed tumors.
Mm. Totally unexpected. You were just warehousing them.
Yes, I expected.
Okay.
And then that was very exciting.
Yeah.
But the number is too small to publish,
mm-hmm.
so we immediately expanded our animal
mm-hmm.
colonies
mm-hmm.
and waited for another 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this time we get more repeated the results, basically,
mm-hmm.
and indeed these mice are tumor-prone
mm-hmm.
and support our hypothesis.
Now, by the time the second group was 2 years old, had you figured out about RIS2 yet?
Yes.
Yeah.
At that time, we had.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, we had.
Okay.
About the same time, I believe,
mm-hmm.
we had this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that interests me about this serendipity is you not only have to, it not only has to happen, but your mind has to be open to it happening.
Yeah.
You know, if Alexander Fleming had just thrown away those plates with the mold on them, mm-hmm. we wouldn't have penicillin.
Right.
So, you...
Yeah, it's absolutely true that it's, luck is only for the prepared mind, as mm-hmm. they say. And you know, definitely we are prepared for anything that's going to happen. And I think this is bound to happen no matter what. If you're good enough, you work on something, you may fail on your initial goals, but in the process of doing this, you should be able to find something else.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the fate come in, mm-hmm. you know. Fate lets you fail something, but also lets you gain something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
mm-hmm.
certainly true in our case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, in terms of you know, a discovery like this one, another sort of ethical issue comes up, which is can or should scientific ideas be owned by anybody? And I know you hold several patents and you mm-hmm. have a couple more pending.
Mm-hmm.
So... And, you know, people are patenting genes like crazy and
right.
whatnot. So
yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, you know, if there's no commercial things attached to scientific discovery, then definitely... We don't need to patent anything. So I think patent, in my view, is still good at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because our work may have some, you know, application that's going to be good for the human society. And on the other hand, so patent our work would actually benefit the society, because that would really... give the people incentive to actually develop our ideas into some products that can be useful.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't have the patent to protect, then it's going to be difficult to attract people to work on these things, because they don't see their effort, their investments being protected. So this is good from developing product point of view. On the other hand, it's good also, it didn't really interfere with the scientific discovery, right? Because in the academic world, you can still do whatever you want to do,
mm-hmm.
regardless whether you have a patent or not. Sometimes, maybe in terms of exchanging materials, it gets slow because some institutes require people to sign MTA, transfer agreement. Sometimes that term...
MTA?
Material transfer agreement.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes that agreement, the terms in that agreement was not very good to the other party, and then they don't want to accept this agreement. Then
mm-hmm.
they may be denied to have those reagents.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I mean, you can say, okay, this hurt
mm-hmm.
scientific discovery. But from the other side point of view, if they have no interest in commercial things, then they really shouldn't care about the MTA agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If all they're doing is pure scientific discovery, then they should be okay with any kind of agreement, because these agreements basically limit their use of those materials for commercial purposes,
mm-hmm.
not for scientific discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, so you can see it's all because of the commercial things that get in the way of scientific discovery. It's not a pattern.
Mm-hmm. Now what about, I know some people are reluctant to share their data because they don't want to be scooped on something.
Yeah.
Do you think that helps or hurts the process? Or maybe it doesn't affect it at all?
Well, that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. People do science that the only reward they get is recognition for what mm-hmm. they've done.
Let me turn the tape over.